kicking out the Tories and stopping Brexit. Are these two aims friends or enemies? That's the question we'll be discussing today in the latest Another Europe is Possible podcast with me, Luke Cooper from Anglia Ruskin University, and my co-host, Zoe Williams from The Guardian. In today's show, we're joined by journalist, author, and agitator, Paul Mason, a high-profile backer of Jeremy Corbyn's leadership of the Labour Party. We'll be chatting Europe and the left, and looking at the tensions that exist between the Remain movement and Britain's Corbynistas. Tony Blair, A.C. Grayling and Alistair Campbell, such luminaries of the neoliberal free market, are never going to be friends of the radical left. So if we want to win over Corbynistas to a Remain stance, then they're really not the way to do it. To feed back to us on today's podcast, find us on Twitter on @another_Europe, or look us up on Facebook at facebook.com/AnotherEuropeIsPossible. Paul, thanks for coming on.
It's a pleasure.
So let's start at the beginning of the story. You've spent a lot of time following the Greek crisis in the Eurozone, really close up over the years. I think this is such a key picture for the left and part of the whole difficulty of the left's position in relation to the European Union. So can you give us just a quick lowdown on what's wrong with the Eurozone and how does this figure in your own thinking on Europe?
Well, I don't think there's just something wrong with the Eurozone. I think there's something wrong with the European Union. It is a neoliberal construct. It didn't start out that way. Margaret Thatcher played a major role in forcing European governments in the 1980s to accept a neoliberal direction, that is a free market, deregulation, low wage, low welfare direction. And in fact, Thatcher's whole support for the expansion of the European Union towards the East was in part to do with NATO and creating a buffer with Russia and the Soviet Union, but it was also to do with basically bringing in governments, I would argue, that were never going to be, you know, civil societies that are barely democratic, civil societies that are, you know, corrupt, much more corrupt even than our own. So the crucial moment for me was the Lisbon Treaty. Gordon Brown didn't turn up. I remember covering this. Gordon Brown refused to turn up to sign the Lisbon Treaty. And I think he was following a good instinct. I don't think the Lisbon Treaty was a good thing. It could even yet now destroy the project of the European Union, because what it did is it just tied Europe by treaty to neoliberal politics. Remember, during the Greek crisis, the IMF, you know, the nasty, horrible neoliberal IMF was constantly trying to get the Greek debt restructured, to get the Greeks to surrender, but in a nice way. And what was it that stopped that? It was the European Union and the ECB. In other words, the most vindictive, not just the Commission, not just Brussels bureaucracy, but the finance ministers of some key European governments, including the Netherlands, in the shape of Dijsselbloem, including Schäuble in Germany, vindictively destroyed Greek democracy. Now, one can say, okay, what was the alternative? And the Greeks looked down the barrel of that and said, we don't want to leave Europe. And you can see now that Britain's trying to leave Europe, how hard it would have been for the Greeks to have been expelled from the Eurozone, put on a path towards leaving Europe itself, European Union. Nobody wants to do that. I campaigned for Remain in a very critical way, and my criticism of the official Remain campaign, which incidentally some of their own people now accept, is it was basically based on fear and lies, and it didn't work.
Yeah.
Now, why is this important? Because I hope and I think there will be a second referendum. And if we fight a second referendum, it will depend for me what deal has been secured, which way I vote. But if we end up basically fighting a second referendum between no deal or hard Brexit versus Remain, I will again campaign for Remain. But there's no way on earth I'm going to go on a platform again with the people who fought the Iraq war, signed off the torturing, signed off the rendition, because it's not going to convince 17 million people, some of whom had a very good point. Some of whom didn't, you know, but some of whom had a good point.
It was a Thatcherite project that turned it into what it was, and it was a Blairite project that kind of maintained that element of it. So do you feel like, from a solidarity point of view, we kind of have a responsibility to remain and reform? Like, even if we could leave quite easily, leaving would be the wrong thing from a kind of left moral point of view?
Well, there's two parts to the answer to that. The first is there is a reform process going on right now in Europe. The problem is it's going in the exact opposite direction as what it should be. In the sense that Jean-Claude Juncker came forward with five options for taking Europe forward. One of them was a two-speed Europe, which I would support. That is to say the countries with a democratic civil society and culture and high-value economies should lead, and the others can choose to take part in a high-wage, high-welfare project or leave it. Now, when the Greek government, even though, you know, they made this massive sacrifice to stay in, they are saying, you know, level up the minimum wages across Europe, level up welfare. Juncker promised 350 billion Marshall Plan for Europe. It never happened. Yeah. Who in the council are their main opponents? Lithuania, Estonia, Hungary, Poland. And for me, my political activity is not just taking place on this island. I spend a lot, probably a ton of time actually this year in Central and Eastern Europe, talking to left parties about this. And two things I say to them, to the, say the socialists of Austria, the socialists of Germany and Italy, is rip up the copy of the Lisbon Treaty that's in your head. If you want to do a Corbyn, fight for a different Europe. At the same time, you ask me, would it be better to stay in on solidarity grounds? The fact remains for me that Britain is always going to be semi-detached from the European project if the European project is to work, because it has to consolidate around the Eurozone. Uh-huh. Eurozone means banking union. It means fiscal transfer. So, you know, German taxpayers paying for bridges in Italy not fall down on people's heads. We're only going to get that, I think, if Britain is detached from it.
Yeah.
No, the form of the detachment, I am open to. It's a matter of what happens at the time. That's why I won't be crying into my soup if we end up with a kind of Norway-style deal.
Uh-huh.
In terms of solidarity, however, of course, Britain includes Scotland, and Scotland, Scottish civil society, Scottish politics wants to be part of Europe.
Yeah, yeah.
So to the extent where you say, should Britain be part, you know, I think in 10 years' time, I have a stronger and stronger feeling that we might end up with Scotland being part of it, and Britain having a Norway-style relationship, or rather, the rump Britain, RUK as we call it, rump UK, will be in the process of breakup at that time, I think, part of the European project via a Norway-style deal.
But, you know, as you said, in that, if the reform of Europe is going in exactly the wrong direction, and you are talking to a kind of socialist resurgent movement across a large number of countries, they need all power to their elbow, right? We need, as the left in the UK, not to just wander off. Don't we?
Well, I think there's two ways of doing that. I think, for me, the answer is internationalism.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
See, look, let's start with France, the nearest country. The French left is Jean-Luc Mélenchon. He hates the European Union. He wants a burqa ban. But the point is, Labour's and Momentum have invited him to the conference.
Yeah.
Not because we agree with him on anything, but because we do support the French workers' resistance to Macron.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
Macron
yeah,
is trying yeah. to impose... Well, to finish the story, Juncker's version of the reform is this. Carry on with neoliberalism and keep Europe united.
Yeah.
That is, neither a two-speed nor a reversal of neoliberalism.
Yeah.
And Macron is trying to do something different, which is he's trying to say, look, at the very least, if we're going to do full speed ahead, let's do it. That is, you know, we're saying to Merkel, banking union, greater fiscal transfers, ultimately a fiscal stimulus is what Europe needs. But when we, the left, try to build solidarity, what we find are beleaguered left movements across Europe because they can't stop themselves from supporting this project, which is going in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
And look back at Mitterrand, François Mitterrand in the early 80s, tried to resist neoliberalism.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
He hired hundreds of thousands of extra civil servants in defiance of neoliberalism, fiscally stimulated the economy. Now, people think it was the finance system that took him down, and it was, you know, it was a run on the franc, etc. But Mitterrand says in his memoirs, I was forced to choose between social justice and Europe.
Yeah.
And I chose Europe. He says that. I think we have to try and create a movement in Europe that says we want a Europe of a certain kind and social justice. And the social justice bit, if you're leftist, to leave the social justice bit as optional, you might as well shut up shop.
Yeah,
so
it's
building internationalism with those movements. The Netherlands, Dutch Labour Party, very pro-Europe, 1% of young people vote for the Dutch Labour Party. I think 5% is what it gets in elections.
Yeah.
It's been overtaken by two other leftist parties, one of which is probably closer to my position, the Green Left Party, runs Amsterdam now. And another one is a very, again, Mélenchon-style ex-Maoist party, is bigger than Labour. Why? And of course, it's because they're prepared to critique Europe.
I think what you're pointing to in the mess of the whole situation is that countries are themselves becoming incredibly polarised and political fragmented. And then on top of that, you also have the fragmentation of nation states in Europe and all of these different electoral cycles going on in different places. So how on earth in that situation do you build the coalition for reforming the whole superstructure?
I would dispute that as a frame, because it's exactly when fragmentation occurs and when polarisation occurs that genuine change is possible. When everybody's putting consensus first, it's impossible to change anything.
So, for example, for every story about neoliberal reform in Europe at the moment, there is another story about people bringing forward progressive reforms. You know, the Portuguese government's proposals for Eurozone reform probably are the, you know, biggest single example of what's positive happening in the Eurozone. They've got the presidency of the Eurogroup now of Eurozone countries. So there does seem to be quite polarized proposals coming forward. And what I found interesting about the Portuguese government's proposals is actually they end up saying, yes, it's a compromise, but they end up saying, well, let's pause integration to some degree to let nation states adopt anti-austerity policy if they want to.
Yeah.
So it's not like more centralization is the progressive answer for Europe.
Yeah, I mean, but the problem there is that Europe has sovereignty, an increasing sovereignty. So the parliament now, which is good, has more effective sovereignty. You know, for me, it's a tragedy that it took the five-star movement in Italy to say we should bust the Maastricht limits on spending. You know, because the socialists are standing there, Renzi, we can't do that. Sorry, we can't do that. Europe, to succeed, needs to become a fiscal transfer union. And then even if Hungary and Poland don't join it, remember, we're talking about a geopolitical system. Putin is trying to break off parts of Europe. He may succeed. But ultimately, if it's a fiscal union and it has a banking union and it has a high social welfare written into the next treaty, then Hungary and Poland can join it or, you know, rejoin it
when
on those basis. And if they don't, if they want to be part of a Russian sort of empire, fine. But either it's a project for social justice, and also more than social justice as well, it's European. I mean, this may sound very universalist of me, even Eurocentric. It is a project based on the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. And if it stops being that, there's no point being in it full stop.
Could you just give us a quick couple of sentences on what the Lisbon Treaty was and why do you see that as key and not Maastricht, which our listeners will be more familiar with, early 1990s, single currency, etc.?
So I marched against Maastricht and the subsequent treaty, the Amsterdam Treaty, that created the euro, because we said at the time, the left, this is going to lock countries in to Thatcherite economics.
Yeah.
That is, there are limits. Off the top of my head, you know, I think it's 3% for a budget deficit and 60% for debt to GDP. If countries bust them, the European Union's sovereignty kicks in order to penalise them. So it's not like you can say, like the Tories at the moment say, oh, we'll spend 20 billion on the NHS and we'll break our own rule.
Yeah.
Okay. The rule for the Maastricht Treaty is that if you break it, European Commission can fine you and take the money back away. So it's impossible. Now, compare that to every other bloc in the world. After 2008, obviously America, deep financial crisis, Obama launched a fiscal stimulus. It wasn't enough. Of course, they've also got a central bank that flooded the market with money. What did Europe do? No fiscal stimulus and refused for 5 years to do central bank money printing. Because the Maastricht Treaty, and I'll come to Lisbon, the Maastricht principles say you can't do money printing. In effect, every few years, somebody in Germany takes the ECB, European Central Bank, to the German Constitutional Court to try and stop this money printing, saying it's illegal under the Maastricht Treaty.
Yeah.
So Maastricht says you cannot do Keynesian economics, you cannot expand the economy. And remember, this is not just an abstract thing. It's there to maintain Germany's ability to play the Eurozone to its own advantage. It was given a better exchange rate against the euro when it joined the euro. The Deutsche Mark was given an exchange rate as a kind of gift for absorbing Eastern Europe. And that's been maintained. But it also basically, Germany runs a budget they call it a Schwarze Null, a zero. The German budget principle is you do not borrow to invest.
So how do you invest?
Well, it's a growing economy, so they still invest. But right. The German train system has fallen apart. It's not just this horrible tragedy in Genoa. Whoever's responsible, it's not just that. The European infrastructure is really falling apart. And you only realize this. I mean, I've literally just yesterday evening got off a plane from South Korea, where I was at a tech conference. When you see South Korea, which is at much lower GDP per head than Britain or Germany, when you see that, you see what's possible in a modern economy. Brand spanking new airports, bridges, motorways, everything runs on time. You know, there are some slums, but we've forgotten what modernity should look like. In Britain, it's because we've had government after government prepared to inflict austerity outside Maastricht, but inside the Maastricht Treaty. Lisbon doubles down on Maastricht. Because remember where it came from. It was a discussion under Giscard d'Estaing, remember him, to try and create a new European constitution. And instead of a new European constitution, they ended up writing neoliberal policy into the treaty, which is Maastricht plus, plus, plus. The principles are not just austerity. The principles are nationalization is wrong. The market is the best driver of the economy. Competition means we have to break up services. And then on top of that, let's remember one more thing. Lisbon empowers Jean-Claude Juncker to do what he's just done, which is to have a meeting with Trump and say to Trump, we will open up European services to you, which means the NHS, which means the Deutsche Bahn, all the nationalized industries that still left. Now, he won't get away with it, but I don't want him to even have the power to say it. Fair enough on Portugal. Let them try that. But ultimately, this project's not going to work unless it has a new treaty. I wouldn't want it to say, do some fiscal stimulus if you want to. I want it to say, this will be a fiscal and banking union, the high value economy, the best in the world. And when there's a crisis, we'll print money and we'll stimulate the economy by borrowing. That's a big ask because you've got row after row after row of blokes in suits, you know, in Brussels, in The Hague, in Paris, who went to university to learn that that is wrong.
I have a pessimistic theory about the problems in Europe that the saviour and the problem are the same cause, which tends to be the electorate of Europe. So the electorates of Europe are nearly always, they haven't emotionally bought into the ideal of European unity. So they're nearly always quite cautious, hostile about further integration. On the other hand, the electorates of Europe have also bought into the idea of being in European Union at the moment. Yeah. So, you know, in Greece, a country that has experienced a depression the like of which the Western world has never really known over the last decade because of the Eurozone, persistently shows in opinion poll after opinion poll support not only for membership of the European Union at 3-1, but membership of the Union at well over 50%.
I mean, you're getting pessimism from this, but there's something optimistic
here.
You're
always optimistic.
I know I am, but there's something here, isn't there, that even if we were to leave Europe, the neoliberal iteration of Europe would still be a problem for us, regardless of whether or not we were part of it. Hmm. So not only is the reform agenda completely integral to the Remain agenda, i.e. there would be no point remaining if we weren't going to reform, but there's no point thinking about reform unless we're going to remain. But actually, if we're thinking about, which I think we will in a second, how we would fight another referendum if it Remain were on the table, this is where we are, right? We have to do basically what the yes vote did in Scotland, which is attach the Remain project to a broader fight against neoliberalism, which is quite obvious. It wouldn't be dishonest to do that.
Can you say, right now, I'm not fighting for Remain.
No, I know.
Which we'll come to why. But as regards Europe, there is, you asked about, you know, how can we dramatise the progressive project for Europe? I think it's going to be the European elections 2019, because lots of people I speak to inside European social democracy are very worried that the right are going to win.
Yeah.
So everybody presumes the Conservatives, the EPP, is going to come first, and then the Social Democrats will come second, as always.
Right. Yeah.
But a new far-right bloc is being created around the Sweden Democrats. So Sweden Democrats have detached themselves from a further right bloc. I can't remember the full details, but it might be worth doing a podcast about it. But the European right is converging.
Yeah.
So you'll get the Lega in Italy, which is in government. You've got the Law and Justice in Poland in government. Uh-huh. You've got Fidesz in Hungary in government. And then on top of that, the Sweden Democrats will probably win.
The Sweden Democrats are a far-right party.
Yeah, but none of them are fascists. They're far-right nationalists. Many of them are anti the EU, but what they will accept is a Europe of nations. So what I've advocated is a red-red-green Spitzenkandidat. So the Spitzenkandidat is the candidate to be Jean-Claude Juncker.
Okay. Yeah.
Last time, the Socialists, the Greens and the far left stood rival candidates. Tsipras was the left candidate.
Okay.
This time, I'm saying we should stand a united bloc. I would even, if it's possible, country by country, have a red, red, green bloc country by country.
Yeah.
I mean, if we get to those elections and on the morning afterwards, the new Europe is either Conservatives 1, far right 2, or far right 1, Conservatives 2.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what will happen to Conservatives 2, it will split.
Yeah.
The German CDU and CSU are already splitting towards the right.
Uh-huh.
The Austrian Conservative Party is in government with the far right. There is a gesture of solidarity, which is red, red, green.
Yeah.
But I can tell you from the discussions I've had, the classic sectarianism of everybody then kicks in and they say something like, Matteo Renzi's thinking of standing and Pierre Moscovici's thinking of standing. And on the other side, you've got Yanis Varoufakis. I'd vote for a centrist social democrat or green minister to be the leader of Europe, because then that puts, as we say in English, the cat among the pigeons. That's not happened for decades.
You're not campaigning for Remain at the moment, but you do seem to have become increasingly open to Remain as an option. And that's kind of intensified since the Durham Miners' Gala. Can you tell us about what happened there?
Well, it's not just the Durham Miners' Gala. The critical event for me is Chequers, and it's failure. I said, when we lost the referendum, the starting point for me is not simply the calculation that Labour has to win 60 to 100 seats where they were heavily pro-leave. It's a more fundamental thing that I want to live on the island with 17 million people who voted Brexit, and for some of whom it was the first time they'd ever voted. It was the first time their vote had ever changed anything. And the subset of that general position is, and something I don't think people in the Milbank Tower have any intention of addressing, is that if that vote is robbed from them in some way, or they perceive it is, the 17 million won't revolt. But remember, 1 million people voted BNP. 4 million people voted UKIP, got Tommy Robinson, got American money. I want us to be able to use statecraft to prevent a fascist-style street movement against the betrayal of Brexit. Now, we often hear this term half-life. The referendum has a half-life, i.e. its results decaying towards being irrelevant. I don't believe that. But the British system is parliamentary. Gina Miller's case won and forced the parliamentary system to ratify Brexit. That was good. Brexit is now owned by Parliament. It's also owned by both parties that said they would enact the referendum in their manifestos, Labour and Tory. And so my calculation is, right, okay, now the Tory party has to enact Brexit. But the Chequers deal and its fall apart and the coming meltdown in the Tory party, I think has signalled to a large part, actually, of that 17 million, what you wanted is impossible.
Yeah.
And so the choice really, because no deal is currently a slogan, but it's not a reality. No civil servant can sign off a no deal Brexit. Industry will collapse. Food will run out. Okay, so the choice is between a soft Brexit and remaining. Now, and I think increasing numbers of voters realise this. That's why that poll that Hope Not Hate did has revealed a big turnaround inside Labour voting constituencies in favour of Remain. I think that will carry on as the Tory mess carries on. So for me, Chequers and the meltdown over Chequers gives Labour permission to say, which I think it should have always done anyway, but it gives Labour permission to say, right, it's fairly clear that the current Parliament will not ratify the deal she's doing. Therefore, we want a general election.
Mm-hmm.
And in that general election, we will still say there hasn't been another referendum. The referendum stands. We will go and we will try to negotiate a softer deal. And for me, I've always argued Norway-style deal, maybe we'll come to why, is appropriate as the outcome of that referendum. But if we can't, and if you don't like what we do, because there's lots of hard Brexiteers who say hard Brexit or remain,
because
they don't want to lose sovereignty in this respect. Come what may, we'll go and give it a go, but you'll get the final say because there'll be a second referendum on the negotiated deal. And it also allows Labour to go into an election saying to the 17 million or what's left of them, we're going to try, but to the others, the Remainers, in any case, you have a backstop.
Okay.
It's realpolitik You know, none of us are in an ideal position, but my sense is the more I've argued this with people, the stronger I think it's resonating through the Labour movement. And I hope it's a position that we can achieve by or before conference. And by position, I mean Norway plus and second referendum.
What's interesting about the last wave of polling since Chequers is that it does show that the Leave vote is increasingly fragile. So 84% of Leave voters think that Brexit is a mess. Okay, maybe that's kind of a given. It's obviously a mess.
It is a mess, though.
Over 50%, importantly, think that the promises made by the Leave campaign won't be realised. But for me, the big figure was the 19% of Leave voters who say they will potentially change their mind if Britain has to sign up to a load of agreements that it doesn't have a say over.
So this is now, your critique of Norway Plus, is that right?
I suppose Or at least we can come on to that in a second. But what's interesting about the Chequers deal, just for now, because Norway Plus isn't at the moment on the table, the Chequers deal is unpopular. And I was shocked by the initial poll that showed over 30% of people supporting no deal. It's come down with all of the stuff about no deal to still over 20%. But, you know, it's not quite where it was. And it just seems extraordinary to me that so many people like would support a no deal Brexit with the European Union and all that entails really makes you feel like a member of the metropolitan elite thinking this is mad. But Chequers in that three preference option poll, so either Chequers and then list a second preference Remain or no deal, or you know, Remain and then give another preference, Chequers was the least popular of the three options. And that does generally raise a problem about any kind of soft Brexit, because any kind of soft Brexit involves signing up to a load of rules that you don't have a say over.
It does, but being in EFTA and the EEA does give you more sovereignty over about, I can't remember now, but about two-thirds of your laws. And for me, my critique of Europe was always that the sovereignty is unequal, so that corporations play in a way that they can't even in America play in the gap between what national governments have sovereignty over and what the European Union has sovereignty over. They literally sort of live in that space. But you're right that the Chequers deal is unpopular. And what's happened is the part of the electorate that understands politics, which is a tiny sliver, has learned by doing. They've tried to do a soft deal that isn't Norway Plus, and it doesn't work. And they're going to get told to F off anyway. You know, it's either Canada or it's Norway Plus. So now the Tories are all over Europe trying to persuade governments. It won't work. The next phase of learning by doing for the electorate is to see what happens in the Tories. I've been told by people in the Labour, you know, some higher echelons, that there will be no movement by Labour on a second referendum until they see who the Tory leader is. My current money is on Hunt. What's happened? Jeremy Hunt has massively strengthened his position in favour of a no-deal Brexit in the last few days. That signals to me he's not going to go for a no-deal Brexit, but he wants to be Tory leader. Because the other complication is that UKIP and Leave.eu, which is UKIP front from my point of view, are joining the Tories en masse. There's a tweet came out saying everybody should join the Tories to take part in the leadership campaign. It's going to be an absolute mess for
them. When you say en masse, though, how many people are we talking about?
Well, we don't know because it's only just started.
Right.
But Leave.eu says, join the masses of people who are joining the Tories right now to stop Remain. Anyway, look, the important thing is Hunt. If it's Hunt, Hunt's just going to be May Mark II. He's going to try and do another soft deal. He'll take it to the wire and it will fall apart. I've always said to people, Brexit's like a football match. It's like a series of dramatic events. It's not like a cricket match. You know, you can kind of, you can a cricket match, you can tell who's going to win, you know, usually on day one.
But it feels like a cricket match, how long it's been going.
It does, but it's like a football match in the sense that, you know, in extra time, the outcome could be completely different to what you think it was at 90 minutes. So one of the ways that we in Labour are trying to do this, people who think like me, is to say we are going to take this issue out of the hands of people like Chuka Amuna, who are in cahoots with all the centrist, bourgeois, neoliberal rendition people in Milbank Tower, and we're going to own it ourselves.
Yeah.
We're also not going to counterpose a second referendum to a parliamentary defeat of Chequers.
Yeah.
Because it's not just a Labour tactical thing. I think it's very important, and somebody like Andrew Adonis doesn't, that Parliament decides Parliament decided on Brexit after the Gina Miller case. Only Parliament can express the will of the people. Parliament decides whether Chequers is a good thing or not. Parliament decides whether the Tories are going to be in power or not. And if we get an election, what I've always wanted is to give a lot of people some skin in a single game. And it gives them a skin in the game of a second referendum. The danger then is that the hard Brexiteers decide to have a rebellion against either soft Brexit or Remain, whichever it is that looks most likely. And we have to find ways of showing them, again, by doing, the problem they never thought about was that the European Union is a regulatory superpower. This is what Sir Ivan Rogers said in his speech. It's a regulatory superpower. Even if you leave it, like you said, you're next to it and you have to obey its rules. So what are you going to do? Remember, Brexit was before Trump, and Trump didn't really reveal his hand as a real serious wrecking ball for the multilateral order until, I would argue, this year.
So then the European Union was able to stand up to him, interestingly enough, and China wasn't. And, the US federal government copies a lot of European regulations directly into its statutes. It's a massive power.
The hard Brexit illusion was we're going to walk away from Europe and join America on a free trade deal. But now America's ruled by protectionists, and what they want is to wreck the world order. And remember, Trump is now supported by serious corporate backers. What they want is Europe to destroy itself as a welfare state.
Yeah.
And Britain's task in signing an FTA with America will be to be the wrecking ball in Europe. So you can sense that some of the people who wanted it are increasingly not wanting it. But it is going to be the problem of the next 12 to 18 months, whether the Tory hard Brexit morally collapses and becomes basically a fascist rump.
Can I just ask, on a practical level, how worried are you that the kind of fear of a Corbyn government / fear of a collapsing Theresa May government will hold the Chequers deal together even past October?
Well, that translates into, will Chucker, Amuna and co. vote with the Tories to support Chequers?
Well, not necessarily, because even Kate Hoey going that way was enough to keep the government up a month ago.
One thing that the Tories all agree on, despite their differences, is that they don't want a new election. Yeah. What's your route to a new election? It seems in that situation, for me, a referendum... And I'm open. I like the scenario, kicking the referendum off a bit further until we can really be confident of winning it. I like it. I like the offer it represents to the electorate. What I'm not so sure about is the short-term pathway in Parliament for that happening, because you need the DUP or some Tories to vote to bring down their own government.
I mean, another way of describing this is to say that it's a conflict in which the forces in the conflict neither can defeat each other. Yes, what's holding the Tories together is fear of a Corbyn government, and because they're saying, remember, they're a machine to defend elite interests, and it's very clear that everything they hold dear, from supporting Netanyahu in Israel to privatising the NHS, everything they hold dear is going to be knocked back by a Corbyn government. And I've always thought that when they think in their kind of Tory kind of grandee way, as the guarantors of the British elite system, that they would always sacrifice Brexit to avoid Corbyn.
Yeah.
And I've even heard that as an argument within the Tories. We exist to prevent a left government in Britain. Brexit's on the other side. I've also heard, and this is, I won't name the people involved, but they're fairly high profile Leave EU type people, say to us, have Lexit. Nationalise what the fuck you want.
As long as
you do Brexit. They want that above all.
Yeah.
And Labour just has to decide what it wants. And I think if it says, going to try and do a soft deal, much softer than anybody, wants on the other side, it's going to be Norway plus, and we're going to offer a second referendum, you'll take a lot of people with you. And then we'll see whether that's strong enough to dislodge this kind of anything but Corbyn situation inside Parliament. Another way of looking at it is, one of those English Civil War reenactments. It's really two blocks of people pushing each other at the moment. In the end, one will give way. And either what will happen is that the Tories will shatter and fragment, or Labour will shatter and fragment. And by that I mean a centrist party will emerge, Subri will join it, maybe Chucker and Moon, who are the people who are meant to be in this spa in wherever it is in Surrey.
Champneys.
Coup.
The Champney 11.
and the existence of a sizeable centrist party might be enough to allow the Tories to say, well, we can have an election, And then that's a chance that Corbyn doesn't win it. These are all things that are in play, and to not acknowledge them is a mistake. But what I hope will happen is that they'll be defeated in Parliament, there'll be chaos, government falls, election. And you know what I really hope? On the end run, Sinn Féin just wake up one morning and say, you know, fuck this. We've got a chance of a united Ireland here. Not Sinn Féin voting. I think that's impossible, but it's a pipe dream. But the issue of what to do about Brexit is intensely shaping Northern Irish politics.
Yeah, but Sinn Féin is never going to think we've got a chance of a united... From their point of view, the best possible scenario is a stupid Brexit, and then the chance of a united Ireland is intensified, right?
Well, they think, and the Republican movement and Irish nationalism in general is pretty... convinced that by the mid-2020s there's a demographic majority in Northern Ireland for unity with the South because of the birth rate and because of demographic patterns. And that is really what everybody's planning for. I mean, the Republican movement is planning for that. Last week I was in Belfast. I was in this thing called Féile an Póbail, which is a generally sort of Irish nationalist-inclined cultural festival. The Wolf Tones headlined it. Ollie Moore's headline and the Wolf Tones. Okay, but there was a whole session where unionists are on the platform discussing a united Ireland. What do we do in a united Ireland? Yeah. What guarantees do we have in a united Ireland? So the idea of Sinn Féin ever voting in Westminster is a pipe dream. It's not going to happen. But remember, if we have a second referendum, what happens in Northern Ireland will be critical. Because what has to happen is that Sinn Féin, the Alliance Party and the SDLP have to convince enough people in the unionist population that voting in the second referendum, either for the EEA option, which keeps Ireland as a united economy, or Remain, is the way forward. And so what the British left does is really important, and what the British centre does as well. I think the second referendum could be won or lost in Northern Ireland. It's 500,000 votes each way, isn't it? And it already voted Remain. Probably number one is going to be won or lost in Scotland as well. I mean, if you think about it, I don't know what the turnout... Do you know what the turnout was in the June 2017 referendum in Scotland? Well, I can guarantee one thing, it'll be higher in a second referendum.
What's it going to take for Lexit to kind of lose its mojo?
I think a lot of people, especially in the centre of politics, think that the resistance to a straight Remain position comes from Corbyn or Seamus Milne or whatever. Obviously, Corbyn's position, as stated, is we're prepared to discuss a single market as long as there's guarantees on state aid competition and labour market laws. But the real push inside the Parliamentary Labour Party against sort of Remain or soft Brexit is from Northern Labour MPs who have to rub shoulders with, you know, people in their constituency who are pro-leave, full stop. And the way it translates as well is this. If you're a Labour activist in the north of England, you know, some of my mates who are left Labour, they spend every night in the pub arguing in the UKIP. In UKIP. The one thing the UKIP always say to them is, mark my words, matey, in a few months' time, the elite will come along and they'll cancel that referendum. They'll find a way. You know, nobody in the pubs and clubs of Northern England and the Midlands is looking forward to the moment when Brexit is cancelled. And especially that would probably include, you know, MPs like Caroline Flint. See, Graeme Stringer, Blakely, voted with the Tories. But Graeme Stringer is not an outlier in the way that right-wing Labour MPs in the north of England, ex-Blairites, think about this. They said, you know, we couldn't win the argument on the doorstep on immigration. We have no desire to go out again and be told to F off with a bunch of, you know, Muslim-loving, liberal lovies. So let's just do Brexit. And that is where, it's not, in other words, Lexit. It's kind of old Labour Lexit.
So do you think the kind of fight Europe because it's a neoliberal construct, do you think that Lexit position doesn't really exist?
Again, learning by doing, I think it does exist. But through learning by doing, what that kind of, you know, RMT, Red London, Benite, it's all neoliberal, what they've learned is that it's also a regulatory superpower. And therefore, even if you leave it, you just don't have immediate freedom to do the anti-neoliberal policies. What you do have, though, and this is an argument I would use against the Lexiteers, is you have monetary and fiscal freedom already. This is the point. You cannot go bankrupt in your own currency, and Britain under a Labour government can borrow till it's blue in the face. Nothing Europe wants can stop it. And I would say that's enough autonomy, whether it's within a Norway-style situation or even in Remain, to do the programme. And then, of course, you do just have to go case by case through, you know, we want to save Port Talbot. Port Talbot, unfortunately, is owned by the same company that owns iMudden, which is the Port Talbot of the Netherlands. No way on earth are you going to save Port Talbot as a unilateral gesture unless you want to nationalise it without any markets to sell into. So we now know it's much harder to do Lexit than what people thought.
Yeah. So actually, it's as hard to do Lexit as it is to do a kind of neo-fascist Brexit that Jacob Rees-Mogg
I wouldn't
wants.
Compare the two. I would just say, in a world of Trump as well, that's fragmenting, in a world where there's now $1 trillion worth of trade protection being imposed in the last year, tariff protectionist tariffs, what would Lexit look like in that situation? So choose your battles, and hopefully, you asked me earlier about Durham. What Durham signified to me is that there's a huge constituency of progressive working class people who want something to argue for. And all we're doing at the moment is arguing against a Tory proposal, against Remain, against Lexit. The Labour leadership need to come forward with something you argue for. Because what's the task of Labour? It's to use this Gramscian term, create hegemony. It's to say, we're left, we're socialists, and there's you, the FBPE crowd. You hate us at the moment, but we do have a joint project.
Yeah.
Whether it's a red-red-green Spitzen candidate in Europe, or it's mitigating the social impact and the xenophobia of Brexit. That's a joint project. And to hegemonize the sort of British middle classes, what you need to do is give them something positive to fight with you alongside for. And I think that is the second referendum.
Thanks to our guests and thanks to you for listening. If you'd like to find out more on what you've heard today, you can check out Paul Mason's regular column in the New Statesman with lots of Brexit chat. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, please tell someone about it, and better still, leave us a rating or review on your podcast platform. You can also feedback to us on Twitter on @another_Europe or find us on facebook.com/AnotherEuropeIsPossible. We'll be back in 2 weeks. See you then.